Black Monday is the name of the stock market crashes that occurred on four different Mondays, October 1929, October 1987, August 2015, and March 2020. 10 weeks ago, on March 9th, the Dow cratered over 2,000 points for its single largest one-day point decline in history. At one point, things got so bad that a circuit breaker was triggered, shutting down the trading floor moments after the opening bell in an effort to keep stocks from falling through the floor. My name is Eva Davis, and I co-chair Winston's private equity practice. The good news, bad news for my practice since March 9th, my last all-cash closing on a major M&A transaction was Friday, March 6th, just under the wire. Since then, my partners on this webinar and our GC guest have all been drinking from a fire hose. For me, it's been advising clients in crisis mode, from drawing on their revolvers, addressing supply chain issues, responding to customer issues in light of shifting demand, communicating in a crisis as clients try to frequently and succinctly address each of their stakeholders through this evolving crisis. My partner, Laura Petroff, has seen changes in labor and employment area at a fast and furious pace, with clients needing advice real time. Cities and states issued stay-at-home orders, new laws were put in place that needed to be interpreted and understood, all while there was an unmatched economic crisis forcing companies to make immediate cuts. For many clients, that path started with workplace protocols for managing the virus. Next was, do we qualify for the FFCRA, which provides paid leave for certain employees and potential reimbursements and tax credits for certain employers? The next step was RIFs, the WARN Act, followed by furloughs, followed by reductions in pay, and then more RIFs. And now Laura is working with companies to help them prepare for return to work. My partner Cheryl Falk has been working with a client to help them respond to a devastating ransomware attack termed extortion by helping them manage the crisis, returning their systems online, restoring operations, investigating the full scope of the breach, and analyzing the U.S. and EU data breach notification obligations to regulators, business partners, and consumers. During the past 3 months, my partner John Schreiber has continued to lead several active securities and M&A litigations, which has included appearing telephonically for court hearings and conferences, participating in a mediation via Zoom, and conducting witness interviews through a combination of video and teleconference. He has also been advising clients on how to prepare for the anticipated wave of new litigation resulting from the pandemic and its broader impact on businesses in the markets. And last, but certainly not least, is our general counsel guest, Wade Pian at Altura Credit Union. Wade has been doing all of the foregoing since Altura has also been shut down in part and working from home and also with his team, some of whom are at work and some of whom are at home. And he's been seeing all of these challenges with his legal department and will share some of his anecdotes and personal insights based on what Altura has been doing. Now, a few logistical items before we begin. You should have received a CLE code form in your confirmation email. We'll announce today's CLE code halfway through and at the end. Submit the completed form to the email address provided on the form. And if you didn't receive a confirmation email or need a copy, please contact Alex Pareca, who is on our original invitation. At the conclusion of the program, you may download a copy of the PowerPoint presentation or listen to the audio file on Winston's website. Look for an email from us with all of this information. Now, how can the legal department lead through all of this? Let's hear from our guests on this topic as we hit on four main areas: labor and employment, commercial contracts M&A, privacy, cybersecurity, and litigation. And I now turn the mic over to my partner, Laura Petroff. Laura, take it away.
Okay, thank you, Eva. Good afternoon, everybody. One of the goals we have today is to make sure that we reduce the feeling that you might have right now of being somewhat overwhelmed by the process, particularly because it's been fairly time compressed, or better said, very time compressed, since maybe late February or early March until today, with the flood of changes that we've been facing literally on a daily basis. We first want to draw your attention to the OSHA guidance. Although they've got some guidance on returning to the workplace, that they actually call preparing the workplace for COVID-19, there's not a specific standard that addresses the issues that we're talking about. There's no rule or set of guidelines particular to exactly these issues. So we have to rely on the OSHA general duty clause, which most of you should be familiar with. I mean, generally, OSHA has the responsibility to maintain standards of health and safety in the workplace. They create those standards, which fall on all of our shoulders collectively. So if you follow the standard general duty clause requirements, that's somewhat of a practical approach, and it's at least a starting point for our discussion today. We've got some elements listed up here. These are the elements that OSHA would have to establish if they wanted to show that an employer was violating the general duty clause when they were returning their employees back to work for the on-site work. And I think the important thing to remember is it's best to be thoughtful and deliberative while you're preparing to go through the process of return to work and to generally rely on practical solutions. We're going to identify a number of those for you today. And they're going to be different for each employer because there are so many different types of employers. And, of course, relatedly, OSHA has different sets of standards for different levels of risk that employees confront. For example, there are different standards for healthcare workers than there are for office workers. But that said, we'll address each of these factors that you'll hear very clearly as I go throughout the next few minutes. Okay, Alex, go ahead and move on to the next slide, please. So the focus here is making sure we have a safe return to the workplace. And the starting point there has to be, when do you do that? How do you do that? Who do you bring back? What's the process in terms of making the workplace safe? And we have a lot of recommendations about that. One of the first things is you really should start by reviewing whatever the return to work order is. Some of those are issued by states, by counties, by cities. It's different. But take a look at those. Some of those actually have specific guidance or requirements on wellness checks, for example. So you need to make sure that you're in complete compliance with those. It's really helpful if you put together a team in-house to guide the process. A team that you can create whatever name you like for it. We've got return to on-site work team. But you want to include members of various departments. Make sure they understand that they're going to be a part of the decision-making, and also they will be accountable and responsible moving forward to make sure that the process that they've agreed to is implemented, and also they're going to have to pay attention to enforcement. One of the most important things that you need to do is to have a communication plan. I think we all know in the employment world that communication to employees is key. It's helpful if it's consistent and if it's frequent. Consistent is probably even more important than frequent because you have to guard against having different people from different departments or different work groups provide different answers to the same question. And of course, again, enforcement measures are going to be important. There are going to be violators. There's going to be issues with absenteeism, all of which will be new issues. For example, employees may present with their own personal illness, or they may try to focus on other factors that they think gives them the right to not come back to work. For example, if they've got a family member who's been exposed or a family member who is vulnerable, say parents or grandparents who are over the age of 65, or also if they've got childcare issues. All of these things are factors that you need to take into consideration. In terms of planned responses to questions that employees raise, again, consistency regarding responses is important. So there have been a lot of employers who've set up hotlines or assigned a single email address for employees to raise their questions, and then they've in turn made sure that they have the consistent answers coming out. And when you're putting together this plan, one of the things that you can look at or rely on, in addition to the OSHA guidance, is other sets of guidance put out by various agencies. And Wade, you had some experience, I believe, so far with looking at some of the guidance that have been issued by some of the various agencies. Can you tell us about what your experience has been?
Sure. As you rightly pointed out, aside from the general duty clause, there's no specific COVID-19 standard, but OSHA has released some interim guidance that they published on April 10th with regard to the obligation of employers to record and report COVID illnesses. The regulatory citation for the recording and reporting requirement is 29 CFR Part 1904. So previously, prior to its most recent guidance, OSHA had carved out the healthcare industry, emergency response organizations, medical workers, firefighters, and law enforcement services and correctional institutions from this requirement. The financial services industry, along with other sector groups, have been advocating for OSHA to add additional flexibility to these recording and reporting guidelines, you know, just because of, you know, some of the difficulty of really ascertaining and kind of, you know, tracing the source of, you know, outbreaks that occur in the workplace versus the community transmission that occurs outside of the workplace. And so in response to that, OSHA has indicated that it won't enforce its guidelines to other industries except where there's objective evidence that the COVID-19 case is work-related. And the example that they expressly kind of pointed out was a scenario where you'd have an outbreak of cases among, you know, workers who work closely together without an alternative explanation. So when they issued that guidance, you know, my HR colleagues here, you know, breathed a sigh of relief. I think it's worth looking at an interim enforcement response plan that OSHA published on April 13th, which details the COVID-related protocols that they will apply to their in-person worksite inspections, as well as investigations of workplace safety and complaints.
Thanks, Wade. That's very helpful. So, Alex, can you take us to the next slide, please? So the next question a lot of us are going to face is, how is it exactly that we're going to get employees to come back to work, to come back to the office? And the starting point, again, you're going to hear this word too often, is communication. It's best to start communicating as soon as you've put together that plan with your team, and you can communicate the types of measures that you're taking. We've got some of the examples for you to see right here, including one of the most obvious, which is creating social distancing measures that are going to work in your workplace. It's going to be different for every employer, every type of employer, but you need to make sure that you have those in place. Not only the how and the what, but also the when is very important. You also need to think about whether some of the employees can continue to work remotely. And this is one of those aspects of the decision where you have to be extra cautious to avoid potential claims of discrimination. Then there's the question of, what are you going to do for the incoming returning employees? Are you going to take their temperature? Are you going to take, will there be other types of tests that you want to use with them? And those are fair questions to ask. Those are things to think about. Some of the return to work orders actually require temperature taking. And of course, if you do, for example, take temperatures or have tests for the employees, you also have to remember that they need to be paid for the time that they were involved in the process of the test taking or even the temperature taking. And you also have to be extra cautious about the records that are created from that. The records need to be kept not in the personnel file, but in the separate medical file if you've got one, and you have to be particularly cautious about confidentiality. You have to consider hygiene issues. And we mean when it comes to hygiene, more than just hand washing, although that's certainly a part of it. The employer is going to have to take on some responsibility with regard to frequent cleaning, with regard to making wipes available, with regard to training people about best practices for coughing and sneezing. You're going to have specific policy about visitors. You're going to have to communicate with staffing agencies with regard to any contract employees or temporary employees you have. Make sure that the same rules are going to apply to everybody. You may need to think about incentives to encourage the employees to return. One of the reasons is that the unemployment benefits have been fairly rich, and some employees feel like it's a better financial situation for them to sit at home with their feet up and collect unemployment. So you want to think about whether you're going to increase hourly wages for the non-exempt workers, potentially give bonuses. If you make any of those kinds of changes for non-exempts, you, of course, then have to consider what the impact is on the regular rate of pay. Again, there are going to be questions from the employees. You want to have a consistent set of responses. A group of people who are in charge of that, that make sure that the same answer is given to the same question. You have to think about what kind of costs are going to be involved in whatever steps you take. You may be providing various types of protective gear, say masks, face shields, maybe other types. There's even the possibility with moving furniture around that you're going to need new or different types of furniture. All these things have to be taken into account. One of the potential accommodations, of course, is whether you should postpone start dates if you've got some new hires that are set up to start soon. And the caution there, again, is to prevent the potential claims of discrimination, certainly if you've got new hires who are either over 65 or pregnant. So, Alex, can you take us to the next slide, please? So if the employees don't want to return to work, the EEOC has set out some specific guidance on these issues. The first one, of course, has to do with the telework. You need to be confident in knowing that telework is not a required reasonable accommodation. Even if an employee has a disability and they just want to work at home on a regular basis, once the rules have changed, once we have return-to-work orders from the various state agencies, then an employee, even with a disability, can't just rely on that. There are other accommodations that can be available, and you need to start the process of having an interactive dialogue with the employees as quickly as you can. Don't wait until they get back to ask those questions. So, Wade, have you faced some of the practical challenges here that you can tell us about?
Sure. For in-house counsel, I believe that, one of the things that I really place a premium on is basing the credit union's practices and aligning them in accordance with EEOC guidance and other regulatory guidance, for the reason that it provides a safe harbor. And in this particular, with regard to these questions, the EEOC, as you've pointed out here on the slide, they've published periodic updates to their technical assistance publication in order to address how federal guidelines and, among other laws, the ADA, the Rehabilitation Act, and the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, will be applied to COVID-related issues, particularly with regard to employers' evaluation of reasonable accommodation requests. And, the safe harbors for me are kind of the key here, because if you do look at the technical assistance publication, it specifically addresses questions relating to, whether an employer is permitted to delay the start date of an applicant who has COVID-19, or symptoms, associated with it, or whether a job offer can be withdrawn because the applicant needs to, there's a need for the position to start immediately, but the individual has COVID-related symptoms. So based on this guidance, here in the credit union, my HR colleagues have fashioned out our existing practices in terms of, we can't, ask someone expressly if they have, if they have COVID-19, but we're permitted to ask if they have symptoms. And, there are tie-ins to the Genetic Non-Discrimination Act in terms of similar prohibitions on whether we can ask whether their family members, are infected with COVID. And so to make it, to complicate it further, I think, there's also the aspect, there's a layering component of it in terms of the interplay of these guidelines with, state state and county requirements. And so California has a four-stage resilience roadmap for reopening various industry sectors. And the governor, along with state health agencies, has published reopening protocols that apply to, among other things, office workplaces. And so here, you know, on our part, we've definitely used that as a playbook in terms of recommendations, relating to, the use of reconfigured, plexiglass in order to protect employees. You know, it's interesting for a credit union, there are a lot of counties that have mandated the use of face masks. For a financial institution, we have 17 branches, about $1.5 billion in assets. When we see a customer come in with previously, pre-COVID, if someone came in, wearing a bandana, they would automatically assume that person was there to rob the place. But now, based on our policy, we are requiring customers, to wear, face masks and face coverings for their own safety as well as our employees. And that's a practice that, our employees follow as well. So it really speaks to some of the challenges of navigating through the issues that are arising.
Great, thanks. That was really instructive and insightful. We appreciate that. So Eva, on to you. You're going to talk to us about a whole new subject.
Great. Thank you so much, Laura and Wade. I'm going to talk to you initially about commercial contracts. And, look, the last 2 to 3 months, Winston, along with a lot of our clients, have been just, again, back to drinking from the fire hose. Initially, the focus was on force majeure clauses, which, look, I won't get into here, but we all learned that whether any particular force majeure provision might apply in the context of COVID really depends on the language of the provision at issue and the jurisdiction. So what do we do now? Because now we've been living with this for 2 or 3 months. We've had, changes with our landlords, and we may or may not be open. We've had changes in shifting customer demand, and perhaps they're not necessarily complying with their contracts with us. We've had shifts in the ability of the suppliers to kind of meet the supply for what we need for our product and services, and sort of what does all that mean? And I think what we're really seeing now is after our clients dug into the contracts to look at force majeure, they're really digging into the contracts and also kind of stepping back and thinking about all their commercial relationships with their, vendor, supplier, customer, landlords, and what does it look like and what do we want it to look like and what do we want it to look like not just for the next 3, 6 months, but maybe 9, 12, 24 months, and is something coming up where, I have an ability to terminate or it's just expiring by its terms and how do I want to look at these and renegotiate them and am I going to be going back to my standard form contracts or am I going to really be thinking about each of these commercial relationships and doing almost a sort of bespoke right now or at least during this uncertain time period, especially if I've seen my business pivot. I mean, I might have been a manufacturing business that was shut down but was able to open because I retooled my floor and am now making PPE. What does that look like and what do my contracts need to look like? And so we are now in the phase where I think folks are revisiting those templates and asking a lot of questions about the client's ability to perform, the counterparty's ability to perform, what that's going to look like over the long term. Have you been in discussions? I mean, now is the time. We talked about, I think Laura or Wade said earlier, you're going to hear a lot about communications as the key. Have you been in discussions? I mean, nobody can kind of blame where we are to anybody, and I think you need to have realistic commercial arrangements going forward. Have you been in discussions? Have you looked at things like limitation on liability, revisiting your termination, revisiting your indemnification provisions? And also thinking about what's your margin of error if there's a miss, whether it's with a client or with a supplier, and were your contracts made in better days to give you guys higher margin, so maybe there was more risk in them, maybe now's not the time. Again, if you're a manufacturer and you're used to having just-in-time inventory, is now the time to maybe have inventory build, which of course will reduce your margin and be more expensive, but it means that you have more certainty about your sources of supply and what's there so you can ultimately make your final product. So this has just been a time where our clients are really refocusing on their contracts. And perhaps, as I said, I think, throwing away the standard forms and thinking about what they might want to look like on a more bespoke approach. And Wade, do you want to share what you guys are thinking about in this area?
Yeah. I think the angle of entry, for in-house counsel might, focus on, first, in terms of existing vendor contracts, as this slide, points out, it raises these issues about raises issues of performance and the application of force majeure and termination clauses. And so, you know, the credit union has existing vendor contracts with the service component that requires, on-site visits and work. And, you know, in the current environment, you know, our vendors are unable to perform, and they cite kind of existing, you know, county, state, and federal guidelines that prohibit them from fulfilling, you know, their contract. If that makes things difficult, because ultimately we have to balance the risk and benefit of escalating disputes over a failure, you know, alleged failure to perform, you know, potential damages, and, you know, our right of termination under these agreements. Similarly, for, you know, some of our branches, you know, we've had construction contracts that have been delayed because now some of the work crews are staggered, and, you know, that has caused intervening delays. And it raises some of the same issues. It also, you know, covers whether or not, you know, some of these, you know, events and damages are insurable, and that's also another, you know, consideration that's come up. I think the second angle of entry for us is in terms of, you know, our customer base for financial institutions. You know, the impact of COVID has been reflected for our commercial borrowers in, you know, the adverse impacts to their ability to fulfill, you know, covenants of loan agreements. And so cash flow, debt service ratios, liquidity requirements, you know, the provision of timely financial information. And in this environment, it's, you know, we are trying to adapt, and we are mindful of, you know, the impact that, you know, the pandemic is having on our customers. On the commercial side, I think the one issue that I'd highlight is where there is a violation of a commercial loan covenant, then, you know, it's incumbent on financial institutions to ensure that, you know, they provide a document, a financial covenant waiver, because in the absence of documenting that, then for additional covenant violations that occur, you know, consumer borrowers can argue that, you know, financial institutions are stopped from raising, you know, future violations. So that's definitely been a kind of a key, you know, issue that I focused on. Aside from that, aside from, you know, in terms of the regulatory legislative impact on contracts, you know, the CARES Act, you know, the CARES Act provides a statutory right of forbearance for commercial borrowers. There's, you know, 30 days plus an additional 30 days of kind of statutory forbearance. The period is even longer for, you know, residential borrowers. And that speaks to the difficulty for financial institutions, because obviously we can't contract out of complying with the law. And in terms of pending legislation on the state side, there is a recent measure that's kind of going through the legislative process, California Assembly Bill 2501, which goes far above beyond what the CARES Act does. It actually, you know, this bill actually provides 18 months of mortgage forbearance for consumers. So it's just, I think the flurry of legislation, you know, definitely will have an impact, you know, on the commercial contract side, and it's just, you know, one of the things that we've looked at as well.
Thanks, Wade. I'm just going to hit on, just to be conscious of time, a couple points under the M&A deal strategies. And I think, you know, look, we're seeing our strategic, you know, company clients act a certain way. We're seeing our private equity fund and family office clients act a certain way. So on the strategic side, the M&A activity has substantially shut down. And I typically, and our firm typically represents deals more in the middle market, say under $1 billion. And those clients have really been hoarding, drawing on their revolvers, kind of hoarding cash. But now that we're kind of 2 or 3 months in, I also think they're considering now sort of opportunities for cash in the future, and that may be selling off non-core assets. At the same time, we're seeing our private equity fund and family office clients, you know, really want to transact in this market if they can. They know that the funds that transacted in 2008 and 2009 on the buy side and 2010 made the highest returns, and they have capital to spend. The issue is if it's smaller deals, there's less of an issue because they'll just go in and pay all cash and do an add-on acquisition. If it's a larger deal, they might get slightly creative and do things like we're seeing a lot of earnouts now. I mean, basically every deal on my desk right now has an earnout and other things that will delay paying the cash consideration. But if it's a more material transaction relative to the size of the fund that needs leverage, they can't really get those done because leverage is very difficult. But they're basically waiting for the leverage in the financing markets to come back to do those deals. So I think with the lessons from 2008 on both the asset sell side and the PE buy side, I do think we'll see the market come back more quickly. I think it has the ability to come back more quickly in an economy like Los Angeles that is in Southern California that is more middle market and doesn't need to rely on sort of big buyout and really super large transactions. And just Wade, very quickly, what are you seeing in the financial services sector in this regard?
I think that there is a trend that's moving towards, you know, consolidation, and it's something that we're watching closely, and it mirrors what's happening with, you know, airlines, hotels, and healthcare in terms of, you know, potential, you know, mergers. Altura, you know, completed a merger in 2015 with, you know, another financial institution that had about $450 million in assets, and that's actually within the range that we're looking at now, the $100 million to $400 million range. And I think, you know, it's, you know, based on existing conditions, that seems, you know, to be, the trend seems to point towards, you know, future consolidation.
Okay, great. Thanks, Wade. And then in terms of stakeholder communications, I'll just be quick here and say that I think across the board, whether it's employees, vendors, customers, even your board, and frankly, whether you're a public or private company, we've been communicating, you know, more clearly, more frequently, more simply, trying not to predict the future, but giving people information around how we make our decisions. So that if things change, folks at least know the building blocks for those decisions and can anticipate what might happen as a result of that change based on what we've said in our prior messages in terms of the issues that we're looking at and what we're focusing on, and particularly sort of staying on brand. Wade, is there anything you'd like to speak about here in terms of communication with stakeholders and key third parties?
Sure. You know, for the credit union, you know, the leadership here, I mean, believes, you know, they really focus on this idea that the medium is the message, and they've tried to take, you know, really kind of strategic posture, you know, in terms of a strategic and consistent posture, you know, in terms of communications across the board, whether it's to, you know, our employees, vendors, and customers. And I think, you know, there is, you know, for our vendors, you know, we've definitely tried to, you know, kind of be proactive in kind of, you know, looking at existing costs, you know, in order to offset, you know, reductions in revenue that the credit union is experiencing, but also just keeping, you know, kind of rather than having kind of a slash and burn kind of approach, really keeping kind of a long-term view that, you know, at some point, hopefully, you know, we will kind of emerge from this, and, you know, that having kind of a consistent and clear message will help us do that.
Eva, are you on mute?
Yeah, sorry, I was just saying. Say it again. Thank you, Alex. Please, our CLE code for those on audio is 05212. You'll need to fill that out on your CLE form. And I'm pleased to turn it over to my partner, Cheryl Falk, to talk about privacy and cybersecurity. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Eva. I'm happy to talk to you about the COVID-19 pandemic, which has triggered a migration of workers out of the office and into the homes. This really enhances the risk to the companies, as employee home environments may not be set up securely and presents a really attractive target for cyber attacks. So we're getting a lot of questions from our clients about how to address these risks, and there's three components that I want to go over with you today. Securing what you can control access to and updating your policies is number one. Number two, partnering with your employees on how they protect company data. And number three, really anticipating and planning to respond to the worst event in the midst of this remote work crisis. So it's really important for companies to consider best practices, specifically considering the remote aspect of their workforce. If employees are given computers to take and work at home, it's important that those computers be encrypted and that they have up-to-date virus and anti-malware software installed. If employees do not have computers available to take home, is the company going to allow the employees to use their personal computers? If so, do you need to update the bring-your-own-device policy to make sure that you incorporate additional information security provisions? Other important things to do are to tighten up remote access, require secure communications to access company data via a VPN, and it's really critical to make sure that the VPN is configured correctly. You know, I know of ransomware attacks that occurred through a faulty VPN connection, so not only do you have a VPN, but it's provisioned properly. Using two-factor authentication is an important tool. What this does is this reduces the problems. If your employee gets phished and their email is compromised, if there's two-factor authentication to access other company data on the networks, this will really help protect the data if there's a phishing attack. And it's important to limit information to employees based on this, you know, really restrict information on a need-to-know basis. And, you know, I'd love to get Wade's perspective on data security with the new remote workforce. Wade, can you share your perspective on what controls are needed for working with remote employees?
Sure. You know, even prior to the pandemic, I think the consensus here and what I've heard from, you know, in-house counsel at other you know, companies is that, you know, cybersecurity was at the forefront of their concerns. And here in California, you know, a big part of that was because of the California Consumer Privacy Act. And so I think, you know, the pandemic has just, you know, compounded, you know, these concerns. And, you know, we've actually seen an increase, you know, with given a larger percentage of our workforce that is currently working remotely, you know, we've actually seen a greater incidence of, you know, ransomware, malware, phishing, and spearing attempts. And so, you know, the credit union has made, you know, corresponding investments in, you know, in its kind of analytics software, its cloud-based services, you know, in order to kind of strengthen, you know, our protections. In terms of, you know, CCPA, even though, you know, these issues implicate CCPA because, you know, even though CCPA took effect in January, the Attorney General still hasn't, you know, published the final regulations on how CCPA will be, you know, will be enforced. And, you know, July 1st was kind of the date that the Attorney General had kind of designated as the starting point for enforcement actions. There's been a lot of kind of industry lobbying for the Attorney General to push back that date because of the pandemic, but, you know, he hasn't chosen to do that. And so it's really, you know, it's something that's definitely weighing on, you know, kind of on my mind and from what I hear from, you know, my other colleagues at other companies, you know, it's definitely a concern.
Thank you for sharing that perspective, Wade. I want to turn to partnering with employees on security. You know, it's never been more important to communicate with employees on how they need to protect data. And we recognize that workforces have been furloughed, IT staffs are pared down to the bone, and it's really critical for companies to make sure every dollar counts. And I would argue that, you know, tightening up employee data protection is where you can really get a lot of bang for your buck. It really starts with making sure that redistribute to the employees what the expectations are. You know, you see different video conferencing. You know, I get invites to four or five different conferences using different measures. Which ones are going to be appropriate for your employees to use? given the data that they'll be discussing or handling, and do they know how to correctly configure it to minimize risk? So letting employees know things like, this is the video conference you should use. This is the FTP site you should use to transmit secure data. By the way, never send confidential data or data with PII through email, for example. Any other specific guidance on remote work would be very important to provide to employees to redistribute so they have that handy. So the second thing I want to mention on partnering with employees is making sure that your employees are patching your computers, making sure that the employees understand that every week there's critical software updates, antivirus and malware updates that need to be installed on the work computers or on their home computers if they're allowed to work from home. We see many companies sending weekly reminders to make sure that employees secure these patches and keep the patches up to date. And the final thing, and Wade touched on this, which is great, you know, we do have the CCPA, which is going to begin being enforced July 1, 2020, notwithstanding that there aren't final guidelines. It's important to remind employees about their obligations in handling personal and proprietary data. And that goes to secure communications, restricting to need to know, and using the data in accordance with the privacy policies. If additional information is collected or used in ways that's not previously disclosed, it may be important to be sure that the privacy policies are updated and refreshed. So, Wade, I want to get your perspective on communicating expectations to employees for data protection in a remote work environment. And I think you may be ahead because you're in the financial institution business, you may well have had these in place before the remote work environment and that you could simply leverage that protection.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that the July 1st, you know, enforcement date is often kind of perceived as, you know, kind of the effective date in terms of just when the, you know, kind of the point in time that the Attorney General will be focusing on. It's actually not. Right. I mean, you know, post July 1, it goes back to any actions that companies have taken to institute these controls, you know, back to January 1st of this year. And so it just covers everything from, you know, updates that the statute requires be made to, you know, online privacy policies. And kind of, you know, making that information, you know, posting it on you know, on a company's website, having the requisite, you know, templates that advise consumers of their rights under CCPA, you know, also updating vendor contracts to document data privacy obligations that service providers have to meet with regard to any outsourced information that involves, you know, a customer's PI. So that's something that, you know, we've communicated to, you know, our employees in terms of, you know, the credit union's kind of safeguards. What's interesting is that under CCPA, the way that personal information is defined is, you know, very, very broad. And so something like, you know, a consumer's email address or, you know, consumer's, you know, biometric data, you know, that's covered, you know, within CCPA. From a practical perspective, you know, the credit union's employees kind of, you know, treat it with, you know, a heightened sense of priority because, you know, the CCPA's private right of action, which is, you know, only applicable to its data breach provision, layers on top of, you know, California's, you know, breach notification provisions, which actually have been in place since 2003. What I've seen with, you know, CCPA is that, you know, the plaintiff's bar you're already seeing, you know, class action lawsuits that are being filed. And so most notably, there have been, you know, there's some litigation involving Zoom. And the reason why we're seeing that is that the plaintiff's bar is taking kind of leveraging some of the uncertainty in the statutory language. For instance, under CCPA, consumers can't file until a company has been provided 30 days notice and an opportunity to cure, but it's really unclear under the statute how exactly a company is able to cure a breach that's already occurred. You know, under CCPA, the statutory damages range from $100 to $750 per incident, irrespective of actual harm. So that, you know, kind of adds to the magnitude of of kind of the risks, you know, that are posed.
That's really helpful, and that brings us to our next and last point that I wanted to make, which is really to anticipate and prepare to respond to cyber attacks. I completely agree. We've seen a dramatic increase in phishing attacks and in ransomware, with the ones that turn into the nasty extortionware. And so imagine if you receive a phone call that one of your employees has received a ransomware message and their computer is locked up, and you learn that it's affected operations in several states. What actions are you prepared to take to stop the infection, restore operations, understand the damage, and the full scope of business exfiltration or use, and assess your legal obligations? Wade, you did a tremendous job in kind of outlining the risks, especially presented under the CCPA with private right of action. And so our clients are asking us, what can we do to reduce the chance of cyber attack? And, you know, the answer is be proactive, be vigilant, and be prepared to respond. And so what I would suggest in this remote work context, it's important to dust off the cyber plans, assess for additional risk introduced by remote workforce, and update the plan as needed, recirculate the plan, and make sure that you have hard copies, that you know how to contact people offline, that you communicate with your employees about how to report suspicious activity, and that you know how you would react if you get the phone call that you've had your data compromised. And so, Wade, with the very short time I've got left before we move to John, can you give us a quick perspective on the importance of having a roadmap to cyber response?
Yeah, you know, I think that this slide covers it, you know, really well. The one thing that I would add is that, you know, in terms of existing the data breach notification provisions to the state that I mentioned, which have been around since 2003, companies have an obligation to notify the Attorney General if a breach involves, you know, affects more than 500 consumers. And in addition to that, you know, even if it involves a data breach of a vendor, you know, that still, you know, the company still has an obligation to kind of provide that notification. And it, on the vendor management side, you know, it raises issues about whether or not there are indemnification provisions and duties to defend where breaches occur on the part of vendors that a company is using.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And now I'll turn it over to my partner, John.
Thanks, Cheryl. And from the litigation perspective, really two main topics I want to cover here. One, as you can see on the first slide, is the disruption to pending litigation. So there the focus is on cases that were pending at the time the pandemic struck and the world changed and what's been happening with those. And the extent to which they've been able to continue and move along. And then the second category is going to be the new waves of litigation that we're already starting to see as a result of the pandemic and its effects, and what else we see coming down the pike. And having covered both of those, I'll bounce it over to Wade for his perspective on the in-house side on all of those areas. So, pending litigation, it's really been a mixed bag in terms of how case schedules have been affected. Jurisdictions have all been impacted differently. Their responses have been different as well. Most courts have remained and continue to remain open for filings. As you might guess, a lot of things have been delayed, but not as much as you might think. A lot of hearings and court conferences are still happening and to some extent still on schedule. It's just remote now. You've probably seen that the Supreme Court is even doing remote arguments now. I've had a couple of arguments, not the Supreme Court, but telephonically with courts so far, and things have gone fairly smoothly in that regard. A lot of courts, instead of having any hearing, be it in person or telephonic, are deciding motions on the papers where they can do that. The big impact really has been with respect to trials, since people aren't going to the courthouses in person yet. And we'll talk about the timetable in which courts may reopen physically. But trials, by and large, have not been happening. There are a couple of exceptions where trials have happened via Zoom. There was one in the Eastern District of Virginia, the Rocket Docket, that was a bench trial in a patent infringement case One interesting note, aside from the fact that it was a trial by Zoom for the first time in the history of the world, was that the defendant in that case, Cisco, objected to that, and the trial was nevertheless held via Zoom over its objection. Another Zoom trial, perhaps even more interesting, is taking place, as I understand it, now, this week, in Texas State Court, and it's a jury trial in an insurance case. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. In terms of live jury trials in person, like I said, they're just not happening yet, and different courts in different parts of the country have different targets for that. The most aggressive, not surprisingly, is that I've seen is at least the Eastern District of Texas is shooting for jury trials live and in person starting in June. Here in Southern California, I think it's going to be later than that. I think the Central District of California had been targeting possibly June. I don't think that's going to happen. More likely, it's going to be July at the earliest. L.A. Superior, it looks like it's going to be more like September and October to get into jury trials. And, you know, a couple of notes there. When jury trials finally do start up again in most jurisdictions, there's going to be a backlog, and criminal cases and other statutory claims and things like that are sure to get preference here. So in civil cases, even where there's a right to a jury, those cases inevitably are going to be delayed. And I think some plaintiffs and defendants in those cases may be faced with a choice of giving up a right to a jury or just waiting a really long time to get that jury trial. And another thing is the realities of what jury trials are going to look like is going to be different. There was an article today about the Southern District of New York and installing plexiglass all over the place and maybe, you know, putting empty chairs between jurors. You know, these are all questions that the courts, you know, going back to Laura's presentation from an OSHA perspective, you've got a lot of employees working in the courthouses and elevators and all of that. So a lot of practical realities are going to have to be dealt with, and we'll have to see how that plays out. If we can go to the next slide. And here we'll talk about, for those pending cases, how parties have been able to push cases along. I think there probably are some examples where, by agreement of the parties and acquiescence of the court, the cases have been able to go into a bit of a deep freeze. That hasn't been my experience with my cases. Schedules have started to slip a little bit. And I've also seen situations where the courts have pressed the parties to go forward. The one example I mentioned was the Cisco bench trial via Zoom. But I've also seen in Delaware that the court has required the parties, and I think it was just one side was objecting to video remote depositions, and court ordered them to proceed anyway. Obviously, that does raise some questions. A lot of parties, I don't think, are comfortable yet doing depositions remotely, with concerns about how you can ensure that witnesses aren't coached or reading a pre-scripted answer, things like that. So that's something that everybody's going to be navigating, you know, how soon we can get back in-person depositions, whether and to what extent in the meantime to go forward remotely. The remote tools work very well for other aspects, certainly for witness interviews, or the friendly witness interviews. They work well for a mediation. I've already had one of those that I think, you know, both sides and our clients had some concerns about the logistics, but it actually went very smoothly from a technological standpoint. It did not result in a settlement, but that had nothing to do with the technology. So those are some of the things that folks have been able to focus on to keep cases going, notwithstanding the changed circumstances. And in general, like I said, schedules, by and large, are moving and shifting a little bit. Jury trials, you know, schedules are moving a lot, and courts are encouraging folks to work together to do that. But things have gone relatively smoothly by most accounts. Let's go to the last slide. And I want to turn to the areas where we've seen a spike in litigation As Eva mentioned, my practice is primarily securities litigation. Given the turbulence in the market, it was inevitable there was going to be a spike there, and there has been. Zoom, in addition to the challenges about the data privacy, that has turned into a securities litigation as well. The cruise lines have been hit, and anybody else's stock has dropped, which is basically everybody has been in the crosshairs there. Products liability is a big one. Anything where there are goods and services that haven't been provided as a result of the pandemic, be it airlines, colleges, gyms, ticket sellers, there's been a lot of litigation in those areas as well, and other commercial contracts to some of the topics that Eva covered. Other areas we expect to see it, insurance, clearly is going to be one, MedMal, bankruptcy, we're already seeing a bunch. Trust claims. I'm going to stop there and see if I can throw it over to Wade. We've only got a couple of minutes left. I want to get Wade's perspective and what you're seeing, Wade, in these areas.
Yeah, based on the information that I received from our insurer, Dave indicated that the number of litigation claims that their policyholders have tendered for coverage has actually increased. On our end, we've also seen some pushback on our insurer's willingness to insure for certain litigation claims. And so, there's definitely a tightening of the belts. And I think this slide, really captures some of the key areas of concern in terms of just on the litigation front. And I would just add to it probably just data privacy and kind of how some of these employment issues will play out as well. So
thanks, Wade. I'll kick it back to you, Eva.
Terrific. Thanks, Wade. Thanks, John. So we are right up at almost at the top of the hour at 1 p.m. Pacific, and it looks like we've answered all the questions that have come through. If anyone had a question that wasn't answered, that somehow didn't come through to us, feel free to send it to our emails that are in the back in the front of our presentation. As I mentioned earlier, look for an email from us with the PowerPoint slides and a small short survey on this presentation. We'd love to get your feedback. And look, a big thank you to Wade Pyun, who is our special guest, general counsel guest. Appreciate all your insights across each of our areas. Thank you to my partners, Cheryl Falk, Laura Petroff, and John Schreiber. And then a special thanks to our team that supported us in this, Alex Pereca, Miranda Espinoza, and Louis Loy. And I hope everyone stays well and safe. Thank you so much.